world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCreary. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.
Do you want to know the latest news or upcoming events? Follow us at Twitter at @PRN_radio or click the Twitter icon on our homepage. You can also friend us on Facebook. Just search Progressive Radio Network. Always new and up to date. The Progressive Radio Network, your home for thoughtful and informative information.
Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, not only with the greatest audience in the world, certainly in the field of mental health, psychology, medicine, psychiatry, neurology. This is your pioneering, cutting edge, talking truth, speaking truth to power in the Quaker tradition of no fear of authority. That's us. And the guest, my guest today, the third time in a row now, the third week with Peter Gercha, MD. Peter, you can find him on Mad in America as an author. His latest book, Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. Professor Gercha is the founder, co-founder of the Cochrane Collaboration. By the way, he's from Denmark. Where a lot of good people are from. The Cochrane Collaboration, which has been established for many years to monitor medical, not just psychiatric. He came to that a little later. I think medical publications for their quality, incredibly important function. He himself is the author of more than 70 papers and other books as well. And I want to say that Peter Gercha, and it's spelled GOTZSCHE, that Peter is a man I respect beyond words. He is brilliant. He is hardworking. He researches the hell out of things. He approaches it with genuine sense of justice and outrage, and yet good humor. He's a great speaker. He's confronting psychiatrists around Europe now. I don't know how long they'll let that go on. They'll probably eventually realize they can't debate him. And he's just a generally fine man. I'm very, very fond of him. Had him to the U.S. a couple of times on for conferences that I co-sponsored, and I've invited him as well, and we'll talk more about this later, to come to a conference that I participate in that surrounds mostly health and nutrition, but they're getting more and more into good nutrition means not taking psychiatric drugs. I'll tell you more about those folks and about Peter's coming over in a later show. I want to have as much to do with this man as I can. And next week will be the fourth in our series and final just for this period of time. And see if I can make them up as a little extra package, but there'll be four in a row. And as you know, you can always download these things on PRN.FM. I'm so pleased to be a part of PRN and also on Podbean. which goes back the many, many years that I've been doing the show. Peter, are you there?
Yes, Peter, and I'm very proud to be in your program, because there is no one in the whole world I have learned so much from when it concerns psychiatry than exactly you.
You know, that's really, really wonderful. But I also want to remind folks, as I've discussed earlier, that unlike most of the people who are critical of psychiatry, Peter came to this on his own without even knowing my existence. So I'm so glad that now that you know about me, that you're continuing to learn from me and I from you. It's not possible to listen to Peter for more than a few minutes without learning something new. And it'll be interesting to see today, because we're going to talk today about involuntary treatment. I want to take about 2 or 3 minutes and introduce the subject from my perspective. Back in when I graduated medical school, I was planning to go to try to get into a Harvard internship. Those usually took a medical internship first. And I'd already applied. And Thomas Zas's book came out. I'd never heard of the man. It's my senior year of med school, applying for internships. His book, The Myth of Mental Illness, came out. And a colleague of mine, I mean, a fellow medical student, came upon it and said, here's this guy Zas, and he's saying the same things, Peter, that you've been telling all the psychiatrists and making them mad in medical school. And so I found Zas, and he was in upstate New York at the State University here, and I called up there, and they said they only had 2 interns. I said, I want to come up. I want to be around Zas. And they had only 2 interns, and they picked them already. I said, what, can I come up and say hello? Yeah, and they said yes. And I came up and said hello, and they dropped one of the other interns and took me, and I did an internship there, which was half psychiatry. It was the only one in the country. And then I went to Harvard for my first year of residency, but they were so awful, so stuck up, so ignorant, so out of touch with human beings. I finished my residency at Syracuse. Left on good terms, but I finished my residency at Syracuse. Well, Zas, I'd been thinking a lot of the same things Zas had been thinking, but I was much, much younger, obviously. And Zas, the one thing he clarified for me, the one thing he made absolutely clear, was that involuntary treatment was a crime against humanity. He wrote about it. He went on to write many, many books touching on that subject, as well as that mental illness is a metaphor and that you have to show it's biological and you can't to call it an illness. It changed my life to realize that there was a real philosophy of freedom that had been well articulated for hundreds of years. And then there was the Constitution of the United States and the Declaration of Independence. And all of it was inconsistent with involuntary treatment. And so my first 2 medical papers were published in 1964. And they were the 2 sides of me that's still on display, for better or worse. One of the articles published in the Archives of General Psychiatry, they weren't afraid of me yet, was an article on coercion of voluntary patients in an open hospital. Because what I was looking at was how even though the hospital we worked in had open wards and rarely took involuntary patients, once you entered, you could be certified easily. You were no longer voluntary. So it was voluntary coming in, maybe, but not voluntary leaving. And I looked at the patient's thoughts and feelings about all this. I was surprised at how many patients were happy to go along with it. But then, of course, there were others who weren't. And my other paper was on the psychophysiology of anxiety. Came out in 1964. So I'm still doing both the biological, psychopharmacology kinds of work, because it was on the effects of adrenaline on anxiety. And I'm still doing the ethical research. And here now comes along, younger than I, Peter Gerze. And he's a physician, and he's doing ethical critiques of psychiatry as well as scientific. So it's like a brother. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Where do you want to begin, sir?
Yeah. Do you want me to start?
Yes. Where should we go from here? I'm out of breath.
Well, you can apply three perspectives on the use of force in psychiatry. The science, does it do more good than harm? The ethics, can it be defended ethically? And the legal issue. So let's start with the science first. I have never seen it documented that forced treatment and forced admission does more good than harm. And I definitely believe that the reverse is true. It does more harm than good. What is often involved is forced treatment with antipsychotic drugs. And these are some of the most toxic drugs ever invented, apart from cancer chemotherapy. They kill many people, and they cripple many, many more people for the rest of their lives. They create permanent brain damage. So it's out of the question that this is done for the patient's own good. I just can't see this documented in science. And that leads me directly into the ethical issues, that we have a highly doubtful treatment with antipsychotic drugs, and it definitely kills some people who beg their psychiatrist not to be treated with these drugs, and then yet they are forced to take them, and some of them die. This is, as Sass already said, a very gross human rights violation that we should never accept in a modern society. It's only soldiers that are forced to do something that can cause them to lose their life. But as I said in your previous program, soldiers have decided to become soldiers. Psychiatric patients never decided to become psychiatric patients. So alone for these two reasons, it's absolutely abhorrent that we allow forced treatment. And we could also mention electroshock that we have discussed earlier. The best estimates tell us that around 1 in 1,000 will die when they are subjected to electroshock. And as you have demonstrated so nicely, Peter, in your books and writings, electroshock is like giving people a brain concussion, like if you fall from your bicycle. You give people an electrical brain concussion, in effect. You damage the brain. You damage the brain, and then you conclude that, well, it's probably beneficial. I cannot really see that this is the case. So now it's over to you, Peter.
The one of the segments I would add to it is the political and social implications. We haven't quite, you mentioned the legal. I don't think you covered that yet. We can come back to that.
Yeah.
But the political and societal implications are vast. It is because of involuntary treatment that we have had the most oppressive institution in the Western world, short of Nazi extermination camps, which has been the state mental hospital system throughout the world, especially the Western world. Because psychiatrists and almost any physicians, and often just people involved in public health, in various countries and states of the U.S., have the right to lock up people for their own good because they're a danger to themselves or others, and sometimes just because they're very ill and need help. So when you can lock up people on your own opinion, and you're a doctor or whoever you are at the time, public health officer, sometimes policemen can get involved in this, nurses sometimes, but you're a physician generally, and you can lock up somebody against their will, you have the kind of power that no one else in our culture has. Nobody. And in fact, the American system of checks and balances and our blessed Bill of Rights is supposed to stop all of that. And the way it's gotten around, this is the legal aspect, the way it's gotten around is that it's defined as a civil commitment rather than a criminal offense. So instead of having to have a jury of your peers and all the other multiple things, all you need is at least for the first 3 days, up to many days, all you need is the opinion of one or two doctors. Then you go to a judge, and the judge, there's no jury, there's no real defense at all, and the judge can then lock you up much more indefinitely. So once you have this system, you produce horrific circumstances. At one point in the U.S., we had 500,000 patients locked up in these giant lockups. Now what it's resulted in is forcing people into outpatient drugging, involuntary drugging on an outpatient basis, very rampant in the United States. Most states allow for it. New York State allows for it. So now almost all the oppressive treatments in psychiatry evolve out of the state mental hospital system. The first insulin coma, killing lots and lots of people with overdoses of insulin, making them docile and dependent when they woke up. Electroshock treatment, which is still with us, lobotomy. Oh, and then, as Peter mentioned, these antipsychotic drugs, beginning with reserpine, which isn't used anymore, lowers the blood pressure too much, and thorazine, the original chlorpromazine. All of these drugs, all of these surgical mutilations, all of these electroshocks, all of these overdoses with insulin, every last one of them were done to involuntary patients in state facilities. So in addition to oppressing all of these people horrendously and the high death rates in these places, which literally at times in Europe, the death rates in the state hospitals rivaled them in the extermination camps. You can read my paper on the murder of mental patients on my website, Bregan.com. Got a lot of science there. So the involuntary treatment then set up all this horrific system, and it gives society the sense that we need psychiatry to protect us. Peter has said there are no studies indicating, there aren't, there are no studies indicating that that involuntary hospitalization helps people. I also, Peter, don't know any studies that suggest or indicate that hospitalization helps people. These are not hard studies to do. I think they've all failed. And there's certainly, well, I'll end there then, pass it over to you, Peter.
Oh, I can mention there is a Danish study that is terribly interesting that shows that the closer the contact you have to psychiatry, the worse in terms of suicide. If you have been admitted to a psychiatric department, your risk of suicide is 44 times higher than if you have not had psychiatric contact in the last year. And of course, you would expect that those who get admitted, particularly involuntarily, are also those who are most ill and who are most at risk of suicide. But actually, what this study showed was that even if you looked at these possible biases, the signal was very, very strong. So there is something in the whole environment with forced treatment that leads to both suicide and violence. It takes away very often hope from people. So sometimes they see suicide as the only way out. It's just so amazing that the psychiatrist cannot see this, how much damage they cause with their forced treatment. Also the fact that force is often used against what the staff sees as inappropriate behavior. And this is illegal, but it still happens a lot. In Europe, we have a committee that looks after torture, and that is the committee that visits psychiatric departments and see what is going on there. And they have concluded in their recent report that far too often patients are disciplined by being put into belts or forced drugging for behavior that the staff doesn't like. So, as you said, Peter, there is nowhere in society where the power imbalance is worse than in psychiatry, because elsewhere in the criminal system, as you said, there is a judge, there are jurors, and you can appeal and things like that. And when lawyer Jim Gottstein in Alaska, he wrote that psychiatrists routinely lie in court. When I read that the first time, I thought, oh my God, that man must be exaggerating. But then he invited me to Alaska to be an expert witness in a court case about forced drugging. And he showed me some previous cases. And I could see that in every single case I looked at, he was right. The psychiatrists were bluntly lying, and just to get it as they wanted. And, for example, these patients could be in treatment with an antipsychotic, with lithium, sometimes with an antiepileptic drug as well, and possibly a benzodiazepine, a huge cocktail of toxic drugs. And then they wrote, for every single patient, the patient has been in treatment with these drugs before without side effects. This is completely impossible, to be in treatment with all these drugs without side effects. It just doesn't happen. And then they copied and pasted also in the sections, what are the prospects without drugs? What are the prospects with drugs? And of course, with drugs, it looked good, and it looked very bad without drugs. And this is not true, because that is also a lie, because studies show that the less drugs patients get, the bigger is the chance of recovery. So we must work on abandoning force. And now comes the legal issue. The United Nations has a handicap declaration that virtually all countries, apart from the United States, have ratified. And according to this convention, we cannot discriminate people with a psychiatric disorder. So we need to treat everyone equal under the law, which means that force must come out of national laws all over the world. I'm trying to work on it in Denmark, but it's very difficult, because just as in court, even when I showed in Alaska that the psychiatrist was lying, the judge didn't pay any attention to it, because the psychiatrist is the expert on psychiatric drugs. He thinks, but it's not true. And I am supposedly not an expert, although I know more about these drugs than most psychiatrists. Then the judges, they follow the psychiatrist, even when I show that they are lying. It was totally devastating for me, this experience. And how can, you said it so nicely, Peter, how can we accept in our society a system like that, where, in essence, the law system doesn't exist for psychiatric patients?
Yeah, I confirm everything you're saying. I went to a hearing in Canada. I tried to warn the lawyer that we shouldn't do this. The hearing was in the hospital, and it was a man who was like a judge advocate, served as kind of a quasi-judge, and it was on the hospital ward, and the psychiatrist came in and lied. And the other thing they do, and they did in that case, is they drug the patient up so badly that the patient can't even express herself. And the judge just sees the patient as this individual who is completely dilapidated, broken down, and helpless, and can't communicate, and doesn't know. It's entirely a drug effect.
Yeah.
It's the typical effects of higher doses of the antipsychotic drugs. It's very evil. It's a terrible sham. I've seen it in the U.S. and in Canada, and you're seeing it overseas. By the way, Peter, if I can in any way join you in any of those kinds of hearings by Skype. You know, I'm a psychiatrist who's been approved in Canada as well as the U.S. That may give me some cred internationally. And I could participate by Skype at some of these hearings. And
that
would be quite a combination. But it is an awful atrocity. I want to point out another aspect of this that I wrote about in my paper on the murder of mental patients, again on the website, and also in a chapter in my book, The War Against Children of Color, which is the relationship between involuntary treatment, the state mental hospital system, and the Holocaust, because the connections are absolute, completely documented, and mostly in European literature, but I cite it, I quote it a lot, and got some translations. The back in 1920, a German psychiatrist named Hoche, H-O-C-H-E, and a lawyer named Binding wrote a book that's roughly translated into Extermination of Lives Not Worth Living. They wrote a book pointing out that all the state mental hospital patients were useless eaters, and it would be greatly to their benefit and society's benefit to do them in. And this book was written in 1920, before Hitler even came to power. When Hitler came to power, psychiatry was already organizing to exterminate its own mental patients. And when Hitler took over, without any official approval, he later did a post-dated letter, a little later, much down the line, psychiatry formally organized to start exterminating the mental patients in the state mental hospitals with poisons and starvation and crematoriums to clean it up. And then they built euthanasia centers, like people don't know these were these places, Hadamar and Sonnenstein. And they then got approval on euthanasia forms from professors in Berlin and sent the tens of thousands of patients to be exterminated in Germany. German patients, not Jews, because Jews didn't deserve euthanasia. German mental patients, exterminated them in the state hospitals, and also more of them even in the euthanasia centers. Hitler eventually canceled the euthanasia program. It's the only thing anybody ever protested. And he turned the euthanasia center that had just been built into an extermination center for Jews and others. And the other extermination centers for psychiatry were dismantled and became the stuff of the first Polish extermination centers. And the first, Peter, the first commandant of a extermination center for Jews was a psychiatrist, Stengel. After that, they gave up on the medical pretense. So there's a direct connection between the involuntary treatment, the state mental hospitals, and the Holocaust. And two German physicians who were at the Nuremberg trials, our military psychiatrist, the representative also from the AMA, Andrew Ivey, they all said at the Nuremberg doctor's trial that, in effect, the Holocaust might never have taken place if psychiatry hadn't been the entering wedge and proven that you could do a mass bureaucratic extermination. This is stuff people don't know, very documented. My book chapter and my article send you to other books and some really good ones out of Germany. And it's, again, what happens if you empower people for the benefit of other people or not, to have power over them. Human nature is such that horrible things happen. So I hope you don't think I'm exaggerating connecting involuntary treatment to the Holocaust.
Well, Peter, you have the history right. This is actually what happened. And I agree with you that if there is extreme power imbalance between in human relations, things go badly wrong. They always do. So for this reason alone, we must get away with forced admission and treatment completely in psychiatry. And a young psychiatrist in Denmark actually agreed with me that seemed to look like a win-win situation, because psychiatrists don't like to use force, but then they always come up with these difficult borderline cases, like people suffering from anorexia or people who are manic, but this can be dealt with without force, even though there might be rare cases where we will miss force. There is no doubt that it will lead to far more good than harm if we abandon force altogether, because then the power imbalance would be much less, much, much less, and the psychiatrist would need to listen to their patients when they complain about side effects instead of telling them that you don't have any insight in your disease, so this is not a side effect, this is a new psychiatric disorder, and now I'll give you some more drugs, and in the worst case, that could lead to the patient's death. There are many examples of that, unfortunately. So to have the power of killing people with drugs is so abhorrent that when I spoke to politicians in the Danish parliament, speakers on health, they were very positive towards my suggestion to get away with force in psychiatry. But of course, the problem is they don't dare do it if they don't have the psychiatrist with them. And the psychiatrists in Denmark, the leading psychiatrists, they have told me they cannot live without force. But the problem is that some patients cannot live with force. They die from it. So it's a very weak argument to say that they need force. And as you also know, Peter, there are regions in the world where force is never used in psychiatry. So it's completely wrong that we cannot have a psychiatry without force. And it's actually a much better psychiatry. And I will give you one example. I know a retired professor of psychiatry at Karolinska Hospital in Stockholm who never uses psychiatric drugs, just like you. She uses psychotherapy. She opened a ward where she decided that force would never be used. And she opened the ward also for psychotic people who had smashed the television and the furniture in previous closed wards where they had been incarcerated, I think you call it. And then when they came to her, she said something like, "Here, you will be met with respect, and we will treat you well. We will not use force. We will only do what you accept that we do, and we collaborate on things. But there is only one condition. If you should as much as demolish a chair at my department, you are out, and you can never come back." And guess what? She has had so many people who had used force, who had been violent at previous wards, she hasn't had a single one that she needed to throw out because they demolished something at her ward. So they understood that now this was different and they were not violent. I have never heard a story that is so clearly demonstrating that violence breeds violence. So when staff and psychiatrists are violent towards patients, they put them in belts, they force drugs into them and so on, it actually breeds violence. It's a vicious spiral. You agree, Peter?
Oh, absolutely. Almost every violent act I've seen in a hospital ward has been provoked by either humiliation or the threat of force, because humiliation is also very powerful on the wards. When I was on the Harvard locked ward, I got to, as a resident, I got to compare it to the open ward at the State University of New York that was under the influence of ZOS at the time. That's no longer the case. It's just an ordinary place now, or ordinary psych units now. But we had a lot of violence and a lot of suicide attempts on the Harvard unit. We had almost none on the open unit, which was this very similar to Harvard. They were both the city's acute treatment centers. So I had it right in front of me. When I tried to tell the people there about this, Oh God, they wanted to kill me for saying it was, first of all, that it was better somewhere else in upstate New York, no less. And when I see my patients, especially if somebody's come in, they've had an experience with psychiatry, which most of my patients who come to see me have, like recently a teenager who was heavily drugged. And they come in, the person comes in this case with a family. Within the first 5 or 10 minutes, I say, I want you to know, because of your experience, that what you're going to have here is entirely different from ordinary psychiatry in a couple of ways. First, I will never lock you up. I will never lock you up. I've locked up no one since I ended my training in 1966. I don't lock people up. Now, if you get, you know, if you start behaving bizarrely outside the office or something, somebody else might, but I will never lock you up. Number two, I'll never use drugs to try to treat you. I want to help you come off your drugs. So if you tell me something very frightening, like you're feeling violent toward your mother, let's say, like you've been in the past, or if you tell me you're suicidal, like you've been in the past, I'm not going to lock you up and I'm not going to drug you. So you can tell me. And I'll just talk with you and do my best and give you my cell phone. And if necessary, I'll throw in an extra treatment for free to make sure you get here when you can't afford it. I will do what I need to do to help you, but without drugging you and without shocking you. And it sets up such a whole different start. It's like going on to that ward that you're describing in Sweden. They're coming into an office that is totally different. The whole sense of what's going to happen is totally different. And Peter, knock on wood, I think it's a blessing from God and good luck too. But I've never had one of my patients kill themselves. And I've been in practice since 68, and I've never had one of my patients get violent toward anybody else in a serious fashion, you know, minor things. So that's partly luck. I mean, that could happen to the best therapist in the world. You could have a suicide, you could have a violence. But I'll tell you a story that fits well into this. When I was at Harvard, I got hit for the first time in my entire life by a patient. And I spent 4 years as a volunteer on the back wards of a state mental hospital. And I think it was the ambulance at Harvard. And I'd never met the patient. But I was sitting with a patient in an office, and this patient was told that I was busy in my office. I hadn't met them yet. They probably already getting tense from being at this intense Harvard ward where everybody got A's in college and medical school so they could get to Harvard, and they couldn't relate to people. The whole ambience was off. And so he knocked on my door. I went to the door, and he smacked me. He almost smacked me with all his might in my jaw. So I said, I didn't fall down. I'm pretty sturdy. I said to him, I'll talk to you later. And I closed the door. Well, when the word got around that this has happened, they wanted to shock him. They wanted to get an involuntary hold on him. But I went to the conference and I said, listen, this is what I'm doing. Maybe you can stop me as head of the ward. But this is what I want to do. I want to discharge him. I want to tell him that violence will never get him anywhere, and I want to discharge him. And I did. I had a supervisor who was a decent human being and discharged him. Just sent him home. He wasn't ravingly psychotic, just wasn't going to hurt himself on the way home, just sent him home. And I got a call later from his mother. She said, I came home, I found my son sitting on the porch. She said, I don't know what you did, Doc, but he's listening to me for the first time that I can remember. And she said, would you take him back? I said, no. No, you only get to hit me once. Make it a lesson for him. You don't get to hit twice. And that my philosophy was so different than everybody else's there. That ward, one of the other residents, had shocked somebody for being threatening in the middle of the night, turned on a shock machine at midnight or 2 a.m. and shocked them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Harvard.
Yeah, it's so incredibly awful. Can I tell you two short stories, Peter?
Oh, please, yes.
I don't deal with individual patients, because I'm a researcher, I don't know their total medical history, but I try to help them in a more general way as much as I can when I get emails and so on. But I did make an exception a year ago. A young guy from a Danish hospital contacted me. I even think he phoned me, and he was on Zyprexa, and he felt very badly about it, an antipsychotic drug, and he couldn't get off it because they forced him to take it, and he was just desperate, and then he contacted me. So based on what I knew about him, I sensed that there was something badly wrong. And he actually stayed at a hospital where several people have been killed by overdoses of antipsychotic drugs. So I was worried. This hospital has a bad reputation. So I called the hospital in order to have a friendly conversation with the chief physician. I'm also a chief physician, so we are colleagues. But, of course, he wasn't there. I couldn't get hold of him. So I got a leading nurse. And when she heard what it was about, she said, oh, but he is delusional. He needs an antipsychotic drug. And I said, how so? He didn't sound delusional to me. Well, he has been on the internet and read about antipsychotics, and he believes they are dangerous. Then I said, do you know who you are talking to? And then she said, yes, I also know about your book. And then I said, come on, you're telling me that a person who has concluded that antipsychotics are dangerous is delusional. And then she became absolutely quiet. I had exactly the same experience when one of the leading psychiatrists in Denmark invited me to his department because he wanted to influence me not to be so negative to forced treatment. So it was a closed ward, and we saw various patients together. And after we had seen one patient and we were alone, he said, that patient is delusional. And it was the same story, because he was afraid of antipsychotics. And I looked at the chief physician and said, you're kidding. That's very rational to be afraid of antipsychotic drugs. And the poor guy knows how they harm him because he has received them previously. And then he hurriedly said, well, there are other indications that he is delusional. So these are just two stories that are deeply frightening, because in a closed psychiatric ward, the psychiatrists define what they think is normal and what they don't think is normal. You have absolutely no chance if you are a psychiatric patient in a closed ward.
It's so true. I thought you were going to add that the other thing that made him delusional was that he didn't want treatment. That's in general, but, not just the drugs.
No, but that one of the leading psychiatrists in Denmark tell me that a patient is delusional because he has read about antipsychotics on the internet and find them dangerous. and he has even tried them himself. I mean...
Oh, God.
Oh, it's so sad. But
and then,
I'm
the patients, often they're very frightened and scared, and they don't think about how to portray and present themselves. So they end up saying something like, this is not a medicine, it's a poison. And then they say, oh, well, that's paranoia, it's psychosis. But it's true. All psychiatric drugs are toxins, neurotoxins. They're poisonous. That's how they work.
Yeah.
And
that's
a lot of my books are, you know, draw that conclusion scientifically. But the poor person who comes in frightened and intimidated doesn't have that ability. I always recommend to people, if you get stuck in a mental hospital, if you get captured and put in a mental hospital, be very, very nice. Be very, very nice. You can't pick a fight. They will destroy you.
Yeah,
and just accept the treatment and hide it if you can, hide the pills, and just try to get yourself out of there as quickly as you can by saying you really want to have follow-up and you've got a psychiatrist and make sure it's all set up for yourself. everything just to get out of there. And then when you get out, you're free and you decide what's good for you. But don't take on the psychiatry. They'll do you in. Absolutely.
Peter, you raised something that reminds me of a very sad story I have written about in my most recent book.
And that book is Deadly Medicines, folks. Deadly Psychiatry, folks. Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. It is one of the most important books in our field ever. Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, well, patients who are experienced in psychiatry and have been at closed wards for long periods of time, they know exactly as you say that they should be nice and behave well. But what is even worse, they also learn that they should not show strong emotions, because then they might immediately end up in belts or other types of force. So when one of their good friends suddenly dropped dead on the floor, being killed by an antipsychotic drug, then it can happen that even a close friend doesn't show emotions, because her friend is afraid that then she might also die by being overdosed with antipsychotics. And this seemed to have happened for this poor girl or woman of 32 called Louise, that her best friend dropped dead on that terrible hospital I told you about. And then she said quietly, "I will be next." And she was killed by her psychiatrist only 6 months later.
Oh,
and God. And the staff somehow interpreted the lack of emotion as a disease symptom in that poor woman. So your comparison with concentration camps is not at all a bad one, because if someone was terribly, brutally killed in a concentration camp, everybody knew that they should not show any emotion, because then they might get killed immediately.
Exactly.
I'm sorry I make so strong associations, but I actually believe that it has some justification.
Peter, I don't think it's possible to exaggerate the horrors that involuntary treatment has perpetrated on humanity. I mean,
no.
We have the Holocaust on the one hand. We have millions of people incarcerated in the Western world over decades, over a couple of hundred years, millions and millions. We have shock treatment given to them involuntarily, lobotomized involuntarily. No one asked any questions when these people were involuntary about giving them these poisons, slicing up their brains, shocking their brains. You know, it is impossible. There are no words, nor are there words to describe how dismal it is to be in a state mental hospital. Now, you'd think that, and if you go to the state hospitals, they're smaller, all the patients are on the streets or in worse nursing homes, all drugged up. They're not any better off. But if you go to these places now, you think that so-called mental illness is a sleeping disease, a disease of apathy and indifference, because that's what the drugs do to people. But I saw these places in 1954 as a student before the drugs came in. And they were snake pits. They were horrors. There's no way to exaggerate. But again, the issue of violence has so much to do with the ambience, the surroundings you create. I was on the violent wards, the male and female violent wards, on a regular basis, often more than once a week, for a good part of my Harvard undergraduate career. And I never was hit or threatened by a patient, never. And I was often there alone, sometimes in small groups, but often alone, because as the leader of the program, I kept the keys the nurses gave me. I went anywhere. They got used to me. I went anywhere. The most threatening thing I ever happened to me was this giant of a man stopped me in the middle of the male violent ward and looked at me, and meant looking down at me, and said, "I smoke Lucky Strike." Then he walked on. One day, two of us, a woman, a young college student and I, we took the whole women's violent ward, everybody who could get up and go, we took them into town by ourselves.
Oh.
We had not a single problem. Word, you could just see them looking at each other and saying, "Best behavior for the volunteers." And we brought them back without an incident.
It reminds me of Jack Nicholson in Someone Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, one flew over the cuckoo. Yes.
Yeah, where he took the patients out for a walk, and then he found a boat, and they entered the boat to go fishing, and then somebody comes and say, "Hey, what are you doing?" And then Jack Nicholson presents the other patients as Dr. X, Y, and Z, you know? And then they all walk.
I forgot that, Peter. That's funny. I forgot that.
Then they all walk onto the boat. But I saw the film when it came out 40 years ago, and then I saw it just 1 year ago, and it was a very sad experience for me to see that film again after all these years, because what is shown in that film, unfortunately, is still happening in many places.
Well, as long as there's involuntary treatment, I think on every level, you know, on the scientific, the ethical, the legal, and this vast political and societal implications, involuntary treatment is a horror show. Again, on the political aspects, involuntary hospitals were the backbone of political suppression in the USSR till it broke up. I don't know what's happening now. But before the USSR broke up, they had psycho prisons. And I remember the New York Times doing an interview with a dissident who had escaped, gotten out. I guess they let him go, and he got to the U.S. And he said that what they did to him that was so horrific was they gave him Haldol. Now, that, of course, at the time and still is a routine treatment for all mental patients. But the New York Times didn't get that, of course, being that they're totally in the tank for psychiatry. And he said, what it did to me is first it took away my latest learning, my political feelings. And then it took away a lot of my medical. I think he was a doctor. And then it took away my love for my family. So he describes the lobotomization that takes place over time with these drugs. So that's another way that involuntary treatment has been used in Cuba and Russia. Yeah. And in other countries, as an outright assault. I did back in, quite a while ago, I did a segment on 60 Minutes when the major media was still open to criticism of psychiatry. Did a segment on 60 Minutes where a group of African-American sailors who were protesting on shipboard were all put into confinement and given shock treatment on the boat.
Oh no!
And you know, I testified about that, you know, for the 60 Minutes show. So wherever you have that kind of power of involuntary, it's completely corrupting. The other side of it we haven't talked enough about that I want to deal with a little bit is the opposite, which is if you don't have involuntary treatment, you have to offer something.
Yes. Peter, may I comment on this?
Yes.
Because the Norwegian Minister of Health finally got enough that the psychiatrist would not abandon force. So she made it into Norwegian law that now psychiatric hospitals were obliged to open medicine-free departments where patients could say, "I want to come to such a department." And some psychiatrists protested wildly, and they panicked and wrote in newspapers, "What should we then do when we can't use forced drugging?" Yes, my goodness, what can you do? Now you need to talk to the patients. How horrible a thought. So it was laughable, their reactions. And the first medicine-free department will open in 1 week's time in northern Norway, and I know the man who will do this, and he has employed staff, so this will be rolling. And we want these medicine-free departments in Denmark, and some money has been set aside to this. So this is one way of actually getting in the right direction to claim we need medicine-free departments. That is the beginning of abolishing force in psychiatry. So you must think about this in the United States, Peter.
Well, we've tried it here very successfully. We had, and folks can go ahead and find this in my books and in Bob Whitaker's books and Google it. You know, we had Soteria House in the U.S., in Great Britain, which was a residential home-like treatment center, most of the time without drugs or with very little drugs. We had experiments in Great Britain and milieu therapy without drugs. But then psychiatry can't stand the existence of the alternative, so it organizes and destroys it. So we have to get stronger and confront this.
Yes, but I'm sorry for interrupting. We'll soon finish. That's the beauty about the Norwegian approach, that the Minister of Health tells the psychiatrists in the whole country, we have had enough now.
Good.
So every hospital will need a department like that, according to our new law.
Well, this is really, really wonderful. I've given seminars on how to deal with a violent patient in your office or in the ER. And I want to tell you what the essence of it is, to relate to somebody who is feeling very, very violent. You have to become the most nonviolent person he's ever met.
Yeah.
You have to radiate that you would never use force. You won't meet his violence with violence. You just want to be there comfortably with him and let him be comfortable.
Yeah.
It can do miracles for people to see that all their anxiety and fear and rage doesn't have an object in this space, that it's safe here. And that's what you do when you have to create those environments, those safe environments where people don't feel they have to stand up on pride, stand up to get even, not take any more crap, and all the other feelings of resentment and fight back that people get in routine psychiatric treatment. Peter, this is a great show, and I'm being hearing the music. So listen, folks, we've been talking with Peter Gercha from Denmark. His book, Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. It's his third show in a row with me, 3 weeks, and we finish up next week with everything exciting we can think about sharing with you. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Peter. Why would